I am Bob Earl. I'm an addict and an alcoholic. I could have asked anybody but Ann to read the traditions. Okay. I never know what the hell I'm going to say. I'm going to do something that's more I've never done before. I'm very anti-thinking. I talk a lot about thinking because I feel it's very dangerous for sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Friday night, I don't like my head. Let me put it to you that way. I have absolutely no use for my head at all. It's of little value except it can add marginally wealth. And last night, or Friday night, after the Friday night meeting, my head said to me, just after the Lord's Prayer was over, it said, "Yes, that's a nice prayer to end a meeting with and a good prayer to end the day with." And as I was walking out the door, my soul said, "Bullshit, it's a marvelous prayer to start the day with." You know, why categorize that prayer as a way of ending anything? Because the Lord's Prayer is a very beautiful thing, and it talks about this day now, and it seems that I have relegated it somehow over 15 years into the hind quarter of the day. It's either to end meetings or to try and go to sleep on, you know, when you're crazy and the mind is running away with our Father. And I don't know why, but it just seems like, I think as long as it is Sunday, and somehow we, you know, since children were brought up to at least equate one day a week to God, and Sunday is that day, I'm not trying to change the format of their thing. And for those of you that hate the prayer, you're going to get to say it twice. But just to, you know, when they turn this thing over to you, they turn it over to you. They're not always thrilled they've done it after they've done it. But if they make that error in front, you know, what can I say? And I think a hell of a way to start this Sunday morning meeting here for me is if we all just had a moment of silent meditation, and then we all stood and we all held hands and we all said the Lord's Prayer. Please join me in a little meditation. Our Father,
who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name,
thy kingdom come,
thy will be done
on earth
as it is in heaven.
And give us this day
our daily bread,
and forgive us our trespasses
as we forgive those who trespass against us.
And lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Come back.
See how much you resist a little change? Well, if I get through this sucker this morning, it's going to be a miracle, I'll tell you that. And I have spent a very emotional weekend for me. Nothing against you guys that have talked, but the ladies knocked me down. I kind of wanted to start the meeting this morning with the Lord's Prayer, because for me, that's really what it's all about. The only hope I have of survival as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and as a sober member of our society is God. Now, if somebody said that at a meeting to me when I was new, I would have headed for the bathroom to vomit, you know. But that's it. I am in awe of the condition of my life today and the condition of my soul and the condition of my attitudes and just generally everything that I've got going. It's incredible. It's not always been that way in sobriety. Everything comes around. Due to timing, it was necessary that because the scheduled airliners were full, I had to charter a plane to get down here this weekend, and there's only a few people in this room that'll mean anything to. But I'm sure they know that already, but the airport for India is Bermuda Dunes, which I thought was God's sense of humor at work again. Geez, don't want to get off on that. I will talk to myself up here, which should make some of you feel a little saner when I'm through than you felt when you came in here this morning. It took me a long time in sobriety to discover that I am a collection of voices. Sadly, most of them are very loud and very wrong. I think education must be good. I don't have very much myself. They threw me out of high school in the 10th grade, but I've been listening to all these people with degrees, and one thing that sort of floated through my mind when these college-educated people were talking was, at least it's a way to keep the head busy. You know, just keep it from screwing around with your life. You know, read the book, dummy. Right. Made good sense to me, which is probably why it's wrong. I owe a lot, an awful lot to a few people in this room. I don't know where this talk's going to go, and I know how it's going to start, and I really don't like it because I didn't bring any Kleenex up here with me, but I may go that way anyway. I don't even have a good shirt sleeve to wipe my nose on. Very good, thank you. Now we can get down to it. Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I've got to start where it seems I'm going to have to start. When I was about 8 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess it was 8 years, it really doesn't matter much, 8 or 9 years sober, I'd been married a couple of times in sobriety, one time prior to the program, and geez, I was frustrated, you know. It was like I just really didn't get along well with the people I lived with. I was quiet, which is not a way, you know, that's my reaction to anything today. And I became very frustrated. I guess I read a thing this morning in the little books that I read in the morning about fear, you know, and I really realized as I was reading it, fear really is it, man. I mean, that's the crippler in sobriety, is fear, unfounded, ungrounded fears, of which we seem to have an incredible amount. And it seems like you fear having money, and you fear not having money, and you fear having the responsibility of a nice place to live, and fear not having a roof over your head, and you fear having a relationship and not having a relationship. You fear making love and fear not making love. You know what I mean? It just goes on and on and on. It doesn't matter. Throw up a category. My head will find two sides to it and be afraid of both, you know. I read this little analogy thing about fear. It was cute. I liked it. It's kind of dumb. I never used to like anything dumb because I was very busy being hip, slick, cool, and bad. Fucking near died, too, trying to be hip. Every now and then, something, a word or two I may throw out up here will probably just offend your head no end, but I assure you, your soul doesn't care a bit what language I use to communicate, as long as it comes from my heart. Only your head will get, well, how can he say that? As you saw, it was very easy. It just just flowed right out. But this little thing I was reading this morning said, talked about a lion that had escaped from a carnival, and this little old lady was sitting in her living room with the door open, sewing, and the lion just roared right through the house, man, and into the closet, and well, she couldn't see too well, and she thought it was a donkey and was very mad about this donkey being in her house. And the lion had hid back in the broom closet deep in the corner, and this little old lady just ran back and got a broom and just proceeded to beat the hell out of this lion with the broom. See, she was going to get that donkey out of her house if it killed him, you know. Finally, the men showed up with the nets and the chairs and the guns and all that, and the lion was more than glad to go. You know, he was delighted to get out of the closet away from the crazy lady. Of course, the minute she saw it was a lion, she fainted. And I thought, man, how that is, you know, with all my imagined problems in sobriety. You know, I always view them as lions, and they're really donkeys, you know, and or don't exist at all. Anyhow, back to the relationship thing. Obviously, my head is trying to avoid it. Wants to tell jokes instead. It's hard to give a really emotional talk in AA if you're insane like I am, because my head never wants to embarrass itself by, you know, crying or making a fool out of itself. Well, let's not be ridiculous, Jesus, you know. I mean, talk about that stuff another time. Maybe it's time to clean a little house myself. Anyhow, about 8 years ago, or whenever the hell it was, 9 years ago, when I was wandering around, a little tired of, kind of frustrated, praying for somebody to share with, a woman, preferably, I mean, I still throw a few conditions in. So, I just sort of gave it up. Things were frustrating, and I just finally gave the magic serenity prayer, you know, the short version, which is fuck it. Screaming it. I mean, I've never said it quietly. When you reach that point, of course, it's at the top of your lungs in the middle of the room. Yeah. That's surrender. It comes that way for me. I don't know how it comes for you. I have to shoot every possible angle first, try everything I know, bend everybody that I will bend, and then just turn it over. I came down to Palm Desert to talk, and I was 3 months late. Some people show up 10 minutes late. I was 3 months. But anyway, it was due to a flood. It was actually due to God trying to get my attention is what it was due to. I mean, Cindy, if you think you're hard, please remember the Newhall story. You know, I went through two fires, a flood, and an earthquake before I realized I was living in the wrong place with the wrong person. Well, I tried. God knows I tried. Anyway. So I came down to Palm Desert to talk, and after the meeting was all over, and you know, you're sort of standing there shaking hands to people, and I'd hate to blow it for other speakers, and sometimes you pay attention to who you're shaking hands with, and sometimes you don't, you know. And this gal stuck her hand in mine and said, gee, thank you, you really gave a great talk, and my name is Taylor. And I took one look, and I said, oh, Jesus, my God, there she is, you know, it's the lady I've looked for years. Been looking for her since I was old enough to know what ladies were all about. You know, I was looking for her, man, when I was out there with needles stuck in my, you know, as far as Tommy would say, turkey baster stuck in my arm, you know. And we went out for a cup of coffee after the meeting. Her suggestion, thank God she was aggressive. Because I just got tongue-tied, man. Couldn't even say my name. That was sort of that. Interesting, last time I was down here to talk in Palm Desert, the room that they arranged for a friend of mine I stay in was the same hotel where she and I had gone for our cup of coffee that night 5 years ago, and now I've landed at Bermuda Dunes Airport, so I guess it's time to clean the slate. Doesn't seem logical, but it seems to be what's going on. I'm talking to myself, just as they say in the British Army, talk among yourselves quietly for a moment, I'll be back. Well, anyhow, that began two pretty dynamite years for us, and we laughed a lot, and we had a pretty good time, and we sort of related to each other honestly, and just basically, I guess it was what I always felt a relationship should be, and it was what I always believed love was. Sort of caring unconditionally about another person, not wanting to change them. And that was nice. After about 2 years of this running around together, we finally decided that it lasted 2 years, maybe we'd get married. She had sons that we had to consider, and a lot of things. And I'm not against marriage. I never have been against marriage. I hear a lot of guys walking around, well, I'll never get married again, goddamn. You know, I think marriage is dynamite. I think it's terrific. I think divorce is equally terrific, you know, when required. I'm no more for one than I am the other, you know. It's takes a lot of pressure out of the situation. But, so we seem to feel that was a good idea. So in December, we were both living, she was living in Beverly Hills, and I was living in the Valley. And we decided we'd go down Laguna and find a house. Seemed to be where we wanted to live, and we went down in December of 72, and we found a house, and we bought it, moved into it. Christmas, I guess it was. I don't really remember, right between Christmas and New Year's. And we got married on the 6th of January. We kept it very quiet and very simple with her eldest son and myself and her and the minister. Just a simple little unity ceremony in a living room. That was the 6th of January, and she didn't feel too well at the time. She wasn't prone to complain much about anything, ever. And 7th of February, finally, she got feeling so rotten that we stuck her in the hospital. They thought she had walking pneumonia by the x-rays, anyway, was what they determined. And on the 10th, they discovered that she had cancer. Now, after we discovered she had cancer, what a bummer to start the morning out with. Jesus, well, okay. Maybe when I get done, you won't think that not being able to have enough money for your rent is such a big problem. We sat down and talked about it, you know. I mean, they said, okay, lady, you don't have long. And she, by her own choosing, decided to pass on the treatment offered, particularly in this country, feeling that it would kill you faster than the cancer would. And we went and talked to a couple of doctors who didn't offer any hope at all. So then we decided we would go back to Unity Village in Missouri, spend some time back there on the grounds. We'd been there before. We went there when we had to make, when we were trying to make the decision whether or not we should or should not get married. We went back there and spent about a week. So we went back there. We were getting ready to go back there to make this trip to, I had to find the spiritual strength I needed to keep my act together, to be the, you know, whatever the hell it is you're supposed to be under circumstances like that. And she wanted to make peace to go home, you know, it's the way she looked at it. And we're getting prepared to make this trip. And she loved plants, so when our house resembled the South American jungle, to say the least. And we couldn't find anybody to take care of the plants. Got your Kleenex on, Cindy? We found somebody to take care of the dog. We got my mother to come up to take care of the dog, and we couldn't find anybody to take care of the plants. Now, we had to leave the next day. That night, well, we'd call a lot of people. You know, everybody, you're going to be out of town or Mexico or here or there or somewhere. I don't know where the hell they're going to be. But anyway, they're all going to be gone. Anybody that we could talk into watering plants for 2 weeks. And I get a phone call from the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach, and it's Tom and Cindy. They've just breezed in from Kansas City and have no place to stay. Interesting timing there, isn't it? We said, well, bring your watering can and come take the guest room. And they did, and we split, and we went back to Unity and spent our time back there, and we returned home. Now, the following 2 months, or whatever the hell it was, there were good days, bad days. There were trips to Mexico. We did a lot of things. But throughout the entire time, Tom and Cindy stayed with us in the house, and they stayed in the guest room, and Cindy was incredible. You know, here she was, this slipper, dope fiend, whatever, girl from the streets, and she rolled up and dug in, and it was interesting to share, that's a rotten fucking word, it was an incredible experience to share this situation with two people who were just trying to find themselves and get their own act together, because it got a little hairy in the end, you know. It got to the point where we would have to carry the lady in and bathe her and things like that. As release seems to have been part of the topic of this convention, she reached the point finally, she got very dehydrated, took her down to, stuck her in a clinic in San Diego. And I was okay, you know, I still figured everything was going to be okay. And Geez, I wonder if I should tell that whole story. Oh, I guess I should. See how much fun I can have up here by myself just talking back and forth. My head ran a game on me when we were in San Diego. It was interesting. Didn't get away with it because if you stay around this program long enough, eventually you will get another power in your life, which, thank God, has got more power than the head has. Oh, is that ever a relief? But I left the hospital one night and drove back to the hotel, and I never liked telling this story. It's really very unpleasant. I guess it's my head hates telling it because it shows what a rotten, no good head it really is. Got back to the hotel about 11:30 at night, and I'm sitting there just being kind of quiet. My head says to me, "Do you realize that you are in the massage parlor capital of the world?" And they make house calls. And it's been a long few months, and it's been a lonely few months, and it's been a painful few months, and there's been no lovemaking. What would it hurt to call and have them deliver a girl and just work out some of the frustrations? Made sense, so I went to the phone book. Usually today when things make sense, I don't do it anymore. And I got out the Yellow Pages and began to read all these brilliantly written ads. Found one that interested me, and I went to call. Took the receiver off the hook on the phone, but couldn't dial the phone. Couldn't dial the damn phone. Well, I had enough spiritual wisdom to know that obviously I'd picked the wrong ad, so I hung up and went back and looked for a different ad. Well, to keep a very long story very short, I must have gone through that 25 times and for 4 hours, and I never was able to make the damn call to get them to deliver a girl. Now, I went to bed and went to sleep, and about 3 hours later, the phone rang, and it was the hospital, and the nurse said that the doctor said you were to be informed of any change in your wife's condition, and they do not feel that she will live through this day. So I had learned not to listen to nurses by now. God bless you if there's any nurses out there, but we are all prone to give misinformation. I drove to the hospital, found the doctor, and he confirmed what the nurse had said. I, of course, immediately put 11 years of program to good use and grabbed him by the throat and said something like, "If she dies, you die." I forget what it was. They weren't too thrilled, whatever it was. And I made a phone call to the two most gentle men I knew in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew if I needed anything at that time, I needed gentleness, because if I didn't get some gentleness around me, I was going to kill somebody. And two very sweet, very gentle men came. That afternoon, I decided to send for a minister. I don't know who for at the time. I couldn't figure out if it was for her or for me, for both of us. And this little guy shows up, nice, beautiful little young guy. You know, you look in people's eyes. After a while, you look in people's eyes, and you know they know, and then you know everything's all right. They don't doubt. They're not concerned. They aren't worried, man. They know. That's it. You know, it's what it's all about. There is God. He does work, and relax. You know, it's kind of what their eyes tell you. Now, the day had drug on. By now, it's 9 o'clock at night, I guess, when the minister got there. 9:30. And he went in and he spent some time with her. He came back out, and he said, "Okay." He said, "I'm absolutely thoroughly convinced she's hearing every word said. She knows exactly what's going on." And he said, "What's necessary for you to do now is go in and sit down, talk to her, tell her you love her, and that you'll support her decision whichever way she chooses to go. If she chooses to go home to her father or stay here." And it dawned on me at that moment that I had not let go, man, not for one bloody minute. Obviously, if I'm running around threatening to kill doctors, I have not yet fully turned the situation over to my father. So I went in the room, I spent some time with her, and I chatted with her, and I told her I love her and do whatever it was she wanted to do. And I meant it. Go on, go home, or stay here. And needless to say, about 20 minutes. And I'll be with you in a minute. About 20 minutes later, she just very quietly went. So there's a message there about release. There's also a message there about God. I became very angry after that. Not at people, but just at God. I really felt I'd been burned. I was really mad, man. I was like, you know, I was out there in the goddamn streets and I'm on red alert and fucking near died for 11 years, man, and left crippled people behind me and, you know, carried in my own scars and broken bones and wounds and bullet holes and all the rest of that crap. And I finally found a flower, I guess would be the best way to put it, and it was gone. And when you take anything away from a taker, they get mad. You know, I was really furious. So I decided I wouldn't have much to do with him anymore. Made good sense. You know, when they burn you like that, you figure to hell with it. Of course, I had spent some hours after that with a very beautiful little guy from Unity who said, "Hey, look, dummy." Well, I don't think he said that, but he said it in better words. He said, "Look, one of the things, if you're going to try and walk a spiritual path, it's absolutely mandatory for you to learn, is that the least important thing when anything happens in your life is the why of that. The why means nothing. The why is none of your business, and it's not you're wasting your time, worth wasting your time on. It's just to go on." But anyhow, I spent a successful 9 months not talking to God, thank you. When any spiritual literature came in the mail, I threw it in the wastebasket. That was a lot of work, because I had a lot of it coming in the mail in those days. Pardon me, but, you know, what the hell. My shirt sleeves are rolled up, and I refuse to use my forearm. Mustaches are terrible when you start to cry. You know, the snot just runs right into the mustache. Gotta loosen it up somehow, man, or I'm just gonna, this is gonna be the shortest meeting in history of this convention. So after about 9 months of successfully throwing everything away, I suddenly turned around and looked and realized my life was an entire disaster. Nothing was going right. I was living in one apartment. The escrow on the house had fallen through. I still had furniture stored in garages, houses, on rooftops. I mean, it was incredible. No money was coming in. I couldn't get a writing assignment at gunpoint. I mean, nothing was going on. So finally, I decided to give him another chance. I forgive you, Father. You son of a bitch, you know. And, of course, needless to say, everything then has turned around and been fine. Now, none of that may have done anything for any of you, but I'm sure you that it was absolutely necessary for me. I have refused to clean that house for a lot of years, particularly down here. It's always been hard for me to come back down here, you see, because this is where we met, and we spent a lot of time here. We went to dances in some little building over in somewhere, I don't even remember where, and there are two, three people here, Virginia and Claude, and a few people who were really, we loved, and they loved us, and were excited about us meeting each other, knowing each other, and it's always been tough for me to come back down to this desert, because I could not step one foot into this desert without bringing it all with me, every bit of it, and maybe now it won't be necessary anymore. I guess not. I mean, Jesus, how much can I ask for? You know, get stuck in the same hotel last time I was down here where we had our first cup of coffee and then the land of Bermuda Dunes Airport, sort of. I'm not too hard-headed anymore. I'd just soon, you know, give it up now before the next plane has to crash in the house or something, you know, get my attention. Okay. Now let's get down to more serious matters. Now, there's a point to that. You know, there's a point to that whole story because it's just one thing that happened to me over a few months' period of time in 15 years of sobriety. I can take that incident and compound it through 1,000 other things through that 15 years of sobriety. And, you know, people have been saying up at this podium all weekend, and man, it is true. It is, you know, when things look the bleakest is when doors are opening. You know, I never could understand it. I mean, I'm a very successful writer today with a 10th grade education. I have failed English ever since the 4th grade. I can't spell and I make more money than the judges that were up here, you know. Now, why did that come about? I broke my back. 5 years sober, I broke my back and became a writer, you know. I mean, if you want to be a writer, go break your back. If you have my kind of insanity, that's what your head will tell you.
Well, maybe if we break our back, we can get the book done, you know.
And at the time that I broke my back, I wasn't too thrilled, you know. I mean, I, once again, was not approaching the rest of life with a hell of a lot of hope. You know, it was like, oh, God, this is the finish, you know, because they were saying, well, you can't stand for long periods of time anymore, and you can't lift anything heavy, and blah, 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 you know, all that crap, which I had heard, unfortunately, seven times before when I was in the streets. People kept hitting me in the back. Those that weren't shooting me in them anyway. And the message, I guess that's it. Man, I have got to talk about the fact that when everything looks the worst in your life is when it's really the best. My biggest problem throughout my 15 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has been that I have allowed my head to interpret what's happening in my life. Now, my head thinks it's very smart. And for one that's only got a 10th grade education, it's really stupid. But boy, does it think it's bright. There's nothing my head does not know about. There's nothing it doesn't have an opinion on. And most people it doesn't like. Don't know why, and it doesn't know why. It just doesn't like them. It's never been able to come up with a reason when I've asked it, well, why don't you like him? My head says, I don't know. I just don't like him. Every time anything happened in sobriety, let's talk about me and God. I guess that's what it's all about, because of the people in AA who loved me and were tolerant enough and took time with me and put up with my attitude in the beginning. Phil was right. We used to ride around all the time talking about, no, we didn't understand anything about the program. We did talk about serenity, decided neither one of us had it, and went on and put the meeting on anyway, you know. My head has resisted a spiritual program since the day I planted my ass in the first chair at the first meeting the first night. It immediately threw up a block against anything spiritual. And I'll tell you how it does that. And it has done it for most people that I know. You come in, and I was living in doorways, sleeping on rooftops, didn't own a car, didn't have any money, didn't have a job, didn't have a girlfriend, had only the clothes on my back, and I'm taken to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting by two Eskimos, and I'm sat down in a chair, and my first thing my head says is, you have really sunk to the pits now. Huh? My head did not say to me, this is the beginning. It said, this is the end. It's all over, sucker. You're finished. And I listened, of course. Looked around the room at the people and said, yeah, Jesus, you know, this is it. My head does not like to read about God, doesn't like to talk about God, doesn't like to hear about God, but it's not ballsy enough to just openly say, screw off! And it will not say, I hate God, because it knows that would throw me into a panic program of reading and prayer and meditation that would destroy it. So it's subtle, you know. It just refuses to read. I open the 24-hour day book in the morning and it won't read. There's nothing there to read with. It's just blank. It's like this, Jesus, nothing on the page. You know. Or we'll read it so fast I couldn't remember the thought for the day 4 seconds later, you know. My head likes what it considers its own personal logic.
Which is very interesting logic, to say the least.
My head's kind of logic works like this. When I was a couple of years sober, I still didn't have anything going with God because I was as afraid that there was a God in Alcoholics Anonymous as I was that there wasn't one, see? Because if there was one, I knew what was in store for me, and I didn't want it, you know. Now, I had no formal religious upbringing, but I knew that if there was a God, he was an old man sitting in a throne in the sky with a book. He was keeping score, and we weren't even. Very simple. And to stand out somewhere in the middle of a pasture and say, take me, I'm yours, would border on insanity. Because he would, immediately. You know. And the reason I couldn't get close to God is because I held to that conception. That the minute I let go, it's over. I will be besieged with disease and pain and poverty and trying to be humble in the midst of it all. My head said, go ahead and surrender, sucker, and you'll be 25 years sober, washing dishes in a 12-step house, talking about gratitude. So I decided not to surrender that day. And the thing that kept me from them is I couldn't understand them, man. I was running scared, see, because my head had sold me out. My head had me convinced that if I said, hi there, Father, it would be an immediate spiritual fist to the head, you know. And my one sponsor, who was an absolute maniac, loud, very loud, always loud, the only time he ever would talk softly to me would be when he would talk about God, which was usually rare and very brief. But he would say quietly, listen, punk. We got along well. You would have had to meet him to understand why. I just smiled when he said that. Yes. Yes, sir. He would say, you're wasting an awful lot of energy running around out there looking for God when the kingdom of heaven is inside of you. And I don't know how you treat your sponsors, but I would always just go, yeah, right, man, you know. Always agreed, yeah, right, yeah, right. You know, what my head is saying, nothing good can be inside of you because you're rotten. See? But I'm not saying that to my sponsor. I'm just going, yeah, right, I understand, you know. And one night at an AA meeting, this guy told this dumb story. But it gave me an understanding of God. But I'll show you how my head turned it right around on me after I heard it, too. It's a simple story, because I couldn't understand how God worked. I mean, I was into rainstorms and lightning bolts. I tried that thing about laying a fleece, you know, the thing about the shepherd who was looking. No, man, not that. It was another, something else. Did do a little time in the hole once for chasing one on a fire crew, but the one has nothing to do with the other. Jesus. Boy, nothing will be sacred when I'm done this morning. Anyway, a shepherd one time was looking for a sign from God, and so what he did, he took this skin of a lamb and he laid it out on the side of the hill and he went to sleep, and when he woke up the next morning, everything was wet. The trees were wet, the grass was wet, all the sheep were wet, he was wet, but this sheepskin that he had laid out there on the grass was dry. Well, now, when you're as tightly wrapped as I am and emotionally mature, what you do immediately, of course, upon reading that, is you take a sport coat out and hang it in a tree in Laguna Beach. He's sort of a bit shrunk. But I was looking, you know, you can't say I wasn't trying, you know. So then I go to this meeting, and this guy tells this story about two men drinking in a bar in Alaska. One was an atheist, and the other was a very religious man. Now, eventually, their conversation swung around to God. And the atheist looked as a religious man, and he said, well, I don't believe in your God. The religious man says, why not? The atheist said, I gave your God a chance to prove himself to me, and he didn't do it. And the religious man says, in what manner did you give God a chance to prove himself? The atheist said, well, about 6 months ago, I was lost about 150 miles north of town in a blizzard. I knelt down in the snow, and I looked at the sky, and I said, God, if there is one, I'm lost, and I'm going to die. And the religious man looks at him, smiles a very knowing smile. He said, why, you must believe you're here. Atheist said, nah, some goddamn Eskimo came along and showed me the way back to town. Well, hell, I was a sober member of AA as a direct result of Eskimos. I mean, that one immediately clicked with me. I mean, I never called this two-bit outfit. You know, I never would have called them. I'd have died first. I mean, I had the kind of false pride and ego and insanity that I would have sat in my doorway and died before I would have admitted defeat. You know,
And I'm sitting in my doorway one day. I knew about AA. I had the phone number in my pocket and a dime in my pocket, and I'd gone to a payphone 50 times and never could make that call. I could not call somebody I did not know who or where they were and say, I can't make it. I had never asked a living human being for anything since I was about 4 years old, man, and got down for the first time in the sandbox. And that was it. I learned to take it all. So as I'm sitting in my doorway, proud, broke, peeing in my pants, Eskimo number one shows up. I went through a Robin Hood phase when I was stealing. And the guy that was standing before me in the doorway, he had six kids. And ever since I'd known him, they'd been on welfare. And he said, I've got a place. Come stay with me and the old lady. My father loves me. He knew I would get out of my doorway to go with him. And he knew that the reason I would get out of my doorway to go with him is because the son of a bitch owed me $3,000-$4,000. See? And he wasn't giving me nothing. There's no charity there, sucker. He owed it to me to take me out of that doorway. I had it coming. And I went to his apartment with him. And I'm sitting there on the couch that night, falling apart, saying, hey, one of these days I'm going to have to call this AA thing and do something. He says, there is a girl down the hall goes to AA. I didn't even know girls went to AA. Right? I mean, the only time anybody here has been in an institution will tell you what the people look like to go to the meetings, you know, particularly 15 years ago. They just sort of drag one leg behind them, bent over, you know, three more breaths and they're going to drop dead, you know. So I went down the hall to knock on the door to see what a girl that goes to AA looks like. I knew what I wanted, and my father loved me enough to see I didn't get it. Because had it been some fox, I would have had to lie. I mean, you know, there would have been no choice, no issue, no nothing. I would have lied. The first word out of my mouth would have been a lie, you know, and it would have stayed a lie through the whole thing, see? Because I'd had to impress. I'd had to say, I got a friend down the hall who has a drinking problem, or my father or somebody, you know. And the chick that opened this door was marvelous. God bless her, wherever she is, man. She's big enough to break every bone in my body. She stood 6'2", 6'3", weighed about 235, built like a fullback, had short black hair and tattoos all the way down both arms and both legs, man. She referred to herself as a hard-drinking broad from Kansas City. She was half drunk and had a half full pint of booze in her hand. That was my introduction to AA, but it worked for me, see? Because I looked at her and I said, I'm curious about this AA thing. And she looked me dead in the eyes and said, AA will work if you want it, and I'm not ready to quit drinking. Well, that made good sense to me. You know, I looked at her, I thought, shit, if I was a big, tough broad, I wouldn't quit either, you know. If I had her size and strength, I'd go right on back out there, you know. And because she was street people, I could talk to her. And I said, I can't do it anymore, man. I'm tired. That was what I was, tired. I wanted a place to sit down and rest. She took me to an AA meeting. You know, 28th of August, 1962. Been unnecessary to drink, take pills, or smoke cigarettes without writing on them since then. 28th of this month will be 15 years. I'm impressed. Because I know, I mean, I live with me, man. I know what it's been, see? I know the kind of insanity that's still here, you know. Now, my head heard that story. Listened to my soul talk to me about how Eskimos got me to the program. And said quietly, all that's well and good, but there are obviously a couple of areas that God isn't interested in. Employment. I mean, it's perfectly logical that God doesn't care where you work or what you do. And God certainly isn't interested in the girls that you date. Interesting, my head should pick the two most talked about topics among guys who are on their knees in emotional pain in AA, money, employment, and women, but that's what it said. You know, you take care of these areas, God will take care of everything else. And like, you know, having had 28 years of practice, I listened to it, said, yes, right, it makes good sense to me, you see. Your head has no power until you agree with it. See? If you don't agree with what it says, you take its power away from it. The minute you agree with it, you just gave it a stranglehold on your throat. So I spent the next 2 years in AA armed with that information. God would take care of everything but employment and girls. Those areas I'd have to work out for myself. Employment, of course, automatically encompassing finances. 2 years later, approaching my fourth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had just been bankrupt through the bankruptcy course. My car had been repossessed. I was sleeping on a couch in an apartment of a guy I didn't even particularly like in AA. There wasn't a girlfriend anywhere in sight in my life. I was working in a car wash for $1.25 an hour. I had a rash on both arms from the detergents, and my hemorrhoids were coming back from bouncing in and out off the hot car seats all day long, right? Those are the areas I chose to manage. My head had convinced me that we needed to take care of those. So I was alone and broke with a rash and hemorrhoids. Didn't take a cake that year. Just didn't feel like it was a hell of a lot of hope for the newcomer. It ain't, babe. You know, you can't tell some new guy come in here and hang on for 4 years, sucker. You can work in a car wash for about a quarter of an hour, yeah. Not have a car, be put in a situation that when central office calls you with a 12-step call, you got to call the guy and find out, first of all, if he has a car, and secondly, if he's sober enough to drive it. If you're sober and got a car, I can help you. If you ain't, I don't know what the hell to tell you. Few people probably went back out there. No, they probably came in saying, Jesus, it's getting strange, you know. So an Eskimo drove through the car wash and offered me another job. I took it because it paid more money. It was still close enough to walk to. And I worked on this job for a year. And I went back to, I guess it seems to be where it's going. Okay. We'll be with you in a moment. I've always loved that prayer where two or three are gathered together. Stick me in a closet and I can have a meeting, you know. I'll tell you how to have a meeting. A lot of people love this. A lot of people already have me taken away in a net when I tell it, but it's worked for me and it's worked for friends of mine, and I am deadly serious. Now, if you're home alone and you're frightened or filled with anxiety or, you know, just buried under that fear of impending doom or whatever and you can't sleep and you're like, you don't call anybody on the phone, have a meeting by yourself. Get out the big book. Get some chairs around. Sit down in one of them and be the leader. I have done it, and it works. Pick someone to read chapter 5. Move over to that chair and read chapter 5. Move back to your leader's chair. It'll wear you out, too. And start a discussion meeting. Okay? Pick a topic and start a discussion meeting. If you can, make the topic the thing that's got you drove up the wall. Now, at home, alone, by yourself, with the big book, holding a discussion meeting, you will wind up in an argument. And it's lucky you can't get a good right hook in it yourself, or you'd probably break your own goddamn jaw. But it will work. And I'm for what works. You know, say I have a philosophy about the AA program is I support what works. If you got to stay home alone and have a discussion meeting, I'm all for it. You know, if you want to lay in the middle of the living room floor and cry and kick your feet and throw dishes and punch your fists through the wall, okay, it's all right. It's really okay. I think the biggest disaster in AA is that somehow the lie has come down that we get well. That you come in here and get better. I have found it to be my experience and the experience of all the people that are close to me in my life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous over 15 years, every one of us has come in here and got worse. We have gotten crazier with each day in the first 5 years, without exception. Because suddenly I'm aware. I realized I shoved chemicals in my body for 11 years so I wouldn't have to listen to my head. Now, when I'm not shoving chemicals in my body anymore, there it is, like a vulture, sitting, waiting, saying, oh, it's about time I got your attention, you know. You almost killed us both. Pr- got a great line out of a book a while back. Somebody read it to me. It said, isn't it interesting that it is the mind that tells you that the mind is the most important thing? I love that. Because this poor sick son of a bitch up here is so never mind. Anyhow, having totally lost my place, which is great. Well, I guess I took the damn job and I worked on it a year and I went back to Colorado. I don't want to talk about spiritual surrenders because for me that's what sobriety is all about. It's continuing spiritual surrenders, you know, and I mean, they can be painful, you know, the more you resist. You see, I've learned from spiritual people, not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that absolutely everything in life is temporary. Everything is temporary. The only permanent thing in a day-to-time, moment-to-moment spiritual life is change. The only permanent thing is change. And yet my head, the only thing it will resist in the world is change. You know, you suggest change to me. I almost had a nervous breakdown over them changing my bed in my apartment 2 years ago. Now that's insane. At first it sounded like a great idea. My back was killing me, man. The bed was like sleeping in a gully, you know, it went like that. Then I went to the manager and said, we ought to change the bed. He said, yeah, God, you should have said something sooner, of course, right? You know, that's always the line. Why didn't you speak to us sooner, you know, like this. I didn't speak to him sooner because my head had convinced me I'd have to knock him down to get a new bed. And I'm sworn to a program of nonviolence, which meant I wouldn't get the bed anyway, you know. So he said, yeah, fine, I'll have it in a couple of days. For the next 2 days, all my head did was talk to me about what a mistake that was. How comfortable it was sleeping in that curved thing. Warm, safe, sort of like the womb, just, you know. The night before they brought my new bed in, I had a nightmare. I had 12 guys standing in the hall with mattresses and box springs and boards and, you know. They brought the new bed in, new box spring, and put in a board and put a mattress on top of it. Lay down on to go to sleep first night, couldn't sleep. Yeah. My head was miserable. Didn't have its old bed. Compromise was, I took the board out, kept the new mattress, and we went to sleep. Yeah. I mean, now, if your head can resist something as insignificant as that, imagine what it does with the biggies. You know, I mean, it's true. It's really true. Anyhow, by now, I'd had this job for a year, and I was approaching my fifth year of sobriety. And once again, my head had analyzed God, spirituality, and AA. And the conclusion it had come up with is that somewhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they had hidden something. It was either another step, no, or some sort of secret phrase. But in there somewhere was something I couldn't find. Because I didn't feel as good as other people said they felt. I didn't have what they had. I had babies who were financially more successful than I was. I was almost 5 years sober and still without a car. Of course, I'd been busy making financial amends for a year, which I hadn't done since I came to AA. You know, keep you broke for a while. I should talk about that, too. God, when does this thing end? Sure hope you're not on a scheduled liner. No. Yeah, I'll talk about it, because I think sometimes it's so easy for any of us who have been sober for a while to give off an air of having it together, which is such bullshit, I don't believe it, you know, or particularly having it together in our early sobriety, and I want to remember what it was like. I want to remember that when I was going from my fourth year of sobriety to my fifth year of sobriety, someone suggested to me that I was financially irresponsible. And I had better learn to pay some of my bills and make some of my financial amends. And as I was working at a job that paid fair money, now was the time to do it. Made good sense to me. I didn't have a checking account by now. My sponsors had denied me that. I'm an old forger, and I also had the attitude, when there's checks, there's money. So I would take my paycheck. Now, this seems sensible. I would take my paycheck. Every week, I would walk to the market with it, and I would buy money orders. Now, I had to go around. The only thing that's good for me is humiliation. There's nothing better for me than humiliation. Greatest thing in the world, man. I had to go to everybody I owed money to and set up weekly payments. I had to set up weekly payments for my support to my ex-old lady, weekly rent payments, weekly payments on the electric bill, weekly payments on the phone bill, weekly payments to Beneficial Finance, weekly payments to people I had stuck up. They weren't thrilled. You know, I mean, just everybody, see, I had to tell them that if you don't take it by the week, you ain't going to get it. Because I had learned that I cannot hang on to it for 30 days. If it is there, I will spend it, you see. Now, I would go to the store, buy the money orders, go home, make them out. And that went fine for about 3 weeks. Then my head got into it. Got home with the money orders and hit the one for 25 to Beneficial Finance. My head said, fuck them. They don't need it. We can take it and go to the whatever this weekend. I don't know whatever it was, but it made sense. I said, yeah, that's a good idea. And I said, of course, now you know where that leads you. You come back the next week, the next 25, and you say, well, they didn't get the last 25. Can't send them this 25. Anyhow, in between 4 and 5 years of sobriety, at whatever age I was, I wound up having to take my paycheck like a little boy to the store, buy the money orders, move over to one side from the window, and make them out in the market. Because if I got home with them blank, I would spend them. Now, that did not represent tremendous maturity and recovery to a lot of people, but goddamn it, it got paid. And I felt better. And that's, you know, do what you got to do to get it done, I guess is what I'm saying. Anyhow, I went back to Denver to this convention, but I had been burdened now by about 2 years with this incredible feeling I was missing something. People were finding something in this program I couldn't find. They were more successful with their relationships with other people, more successful with their jobs, with money. I don't know, they just seemed to feel better. I was getting tighter by the day. You know, I'm getting, the longer I'm sober, the crazier I'm getting. I'm getting wired, man. And I hate to admit this, and it took me years to admit this from a podium. I finally, out of total frustration, with complete mental faculty, sat down with a black light to read the big book, knowing they had put the secret in there in invisible ink. Now, if you've ever sat up all night and read between the lines with the black light, the only thing, two things you'll get is a stiff neck and acid indigestion, and you will not learn a thing, man. So if you think the secret's in there, an invisible ink, forget it. It ain't there, man. So I go back to Denver to this convention. I've been working as a diecaster for a year now, and I was really frustrated, you know. I knew I was empty is what I was. I was spiritually empty. That's what I was. Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Insight. Jeez, I wish I had a pencil. I'd write it down. Anyway. We went to the convention for a week and everything. We got ready to come home, and we pulled away from the clubhouse, and we turned the corner, and a tie rod on the front of the car broke. Now, it was a brand new Dodge. There was no apparent reason for this tie rod to break. I found out later that the guy who owned the car had taken it to the gas station to have a tire changed, and an Eskimo at the gas station had dropped it off the jack, and it had bent the tie rod, so, you know, a couple of days later, it snapped. Now, an Eskimo and his wife pulled in right behind us. Like Charlie Snowshoes. I hate going to Charlie. I won't even bother. This guy and his wife pulled in right behind us, and he was an Eskimo. We needed help. There he was. But he was not really my kind of Eskimo in that he was... See, I cleaned up and got sober in Pasadena, and I took a lot of men in Pasadena, and I dropped them into the category that I call Charlie Snowshoes. It seemed like alcohol interfered with their life, but at least they had one. You know... I mean, their kids were in universities, they were running corporations. About the worst thing that happened is one day they humiliated themselves by passing out on the 18th green at the country club and said, screw it, I've got to give this up, and they'd been sober 20 years, you know. Their lives were in better shape drunk than mine was sober, you know. So I just never, we never talked a lot to each other because we never understood each other a hell of a lot, you know. So this guy and his wife pulling right behind us, and I said, well, of course, it's Charlie Snowshoes. He's about 43 years of age, prematurely gray, soft, gentle face, little lovely wife next to him, three-year-old baby daughter. And when you're in trouble, you accept whatever Eskimo you get, right? So now, the spiritual, first very heavy spiritual move this man made is when we found out the car was under warranty and couldn't be repaired till the next day, he said to us, look, we will get the car towed in, and the six of you can come stay at our house. Tomorrow, after they had finished repairing it, we would pack a lunch and put you on the road back to California. There is a very powerful spiritual message in that. He knew none of us. He had seen us at the convention and knew none of us.
And he is saying, come to my house, I will house you and I will feed you. No questions asked. And put you on the road home. He took the girls out to the house first, came back, got the rest of us. We got out into southeast Denver, swung into the circular drive in front of this big brick house. There was another new car in the driveway, and it was just confirmed it was Charlie Snowshoes. Walked through the house in a spiritual frame of mind, priced the furniture to the best of my ability. Found it all to be very expensive. Give you an idea as to the size of the house. He put all six of us in beds without compromising anybody's morals and without inconveniencing his own family. That night we were all sitting around a large wood table in the kitchen, old big oak table, having coffee, and Charlie Snowshoes looks across the table at me. He said, I was very glad to hear you talk about drugs at the convention. My head immediately said, what the hell does Charlie Snowshoes in Denver, Colorado want to know about dope? Unless, of course, the logic is they got a kid locked in the closet, right? So I said, why? And he looks at his wife and he smiles a very soft, very spiritual smile. He used to think it was a stupid smile. I realize now it was a spiritual smile. He said, well, mother doesn't like me to talk about this. He said, but I am a three-time loser for drug addiction from California. That's Charlie Snowshoes, right? He said, I went to AA, that shows you how smart my head is. He said, I went to AA meetings in Quentin, and I went to AA meetings in Folsom, man. He said, it didn't take. He said, I came to Denver 2 days over 4 years ago, and I was 2 days clean. He said, I walked into the clubhouse in downtown Denver here, and mother was working behind the counter serving food. That's a Skid Row clubhouse. He said, I remember what the people in AA had said about if you want what we have. And he said, I wanted what the lady had, and I knew that with her I would be able to stay clean and stay sober. I'm sitting at the table with my mind working like a bloody computer. First of all, I've got more time on the program than he has. Secondly, his jacket is worse than mine. He's got 3 major felony convictions. I've got 13 major felony arrests, but only 1 conviction. And I finally knew I had found the man who was going to tell me what the secret was. You see, because I had figured it out logically. His wife obviously didn't have the money. She wouldn't have been working in the Skid Row clubhouse serving food. Nobody will give a 3-time loser junkie a decent enough job to make the kind of bread to live the way he was living. That leaves us one of 2 possible solutions. A, he found the secret. B, he's still stealing. See? That's my logic. I worked it out. I looked at him and I said, I know this next question is going to sound ridiculous, seeing as how we both belong to the same fellowship, and we both try and practice the same 12 principles in our life on a daily basis. I said, but would you mind explaining all this to me? Again, he looks at his wife. Again, he smiles the same soft spiritual smile. He said, mother and I go to a lot of meetings, and we take the third step every morning. At which point I got hysterical. I was almost 5 years sober, and for the first time in 5 years, I heard the third step of AA. It finally reached the soul. It got past the machinery here that was categorizing, compartmentizing, and figuring it out, and it got down here. And when it got down here, it said, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, period. It didn't say minus girlfriends, minus jobs, minus employment, minus money, minus apartments, minus nothing. It said, throw in the goddamn towel and quit thinking, is what it said to me. You know. I'll ask Sahara, stayed up all night, you know. Came back to California. Went back to work. One day. Came home that night. Sat down in my apartment. I was about, I don't know, a month away from my 5th birthday. I was as tired and as worn out and as frustrated and as crazy at that moment as I was the day I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was right on the edge. I looked up at the ceiling in my apartment, and a lot of thought went into this prayer. I said, if you're not there, I'm fucked. For a spiritual meeting, I would love to change the phraseology, guys, but that was the prayer. I was just about to die. I had come to the awareness that if there was no God, if there in fact was no power greater than me, I would have to die or kill somebody else. But it was over for me. I went to work the next day.
I placed a brand new Allen head wrench into a brand new Allen head bolt. It slipped, which is impossible, and I went backwards against one of the furnaces and crushed two vertebrae in my back. Short time later, I'm laying in the emergency hospital in Van Nuys, and my head is screaming at the ceiling in the emergency room saying, "See, he waited 5 years just to get you. You surrendered and he broke your back." Made good sense to me. But now I had touched a new source in here. And the new source in here said to my head, "Why don't you shut up?" And I agreed with this source for the first time. I said, "Yeah, I think I will. I am very tired. I had been thinking for 5 years, and I had no more mileage left, man. I was, you know, I should have been in psycho instead of, you know, in the back department. It would have been better just to wheel me in for heads, you know, and screw the back. It'll heal itself. The head, unfortunately, you know. They say there's a wrench for every nut in AA. I'm still looking, man, because this thing refuses to fix. I went about doing what was put in front of me to do. Just simplified my life. Completely and totally. Got it down to today. Got it down to the moment. Showed up at vocational rehabilitation. Showed up and filled out the forms for disability insurance. Showed up at the doctor's and got put in one more back brace one more time. And in December of that same year, I decided that I thought I might like to try and write. I have mentioned it to two friends, and that was the last two people I talked to. Because they knew where I came from, right? 10th grade education, can't spell, failed English ever since the 4th grade, didn't know anybody that wrote anything ever about anything, and never read much. Right? So I tried it anyway. Because it seemed it was an inside thing. It was not an intellectual thing. Because to my head, it made no sense. My head said, "What a waste of time this is. Become a social worker." You know. And I'd gone through a thing with rehabilitation. I proved to him that vocational aptitude tests don't work. I took 3 different tests, 3 different days in a row. I came out a concert pianist, a social worker, and a forestry ranger. You know. And I said, "That's only a small part of the people I've got, you know. Give me some more, man. I'll come up with more categories, you know." Of course, one thing I didn't come up with was a writer. It's an intellectual test, not a spiritual one. Anyhow, cut all the bullshit out, man. I sat down and began to write, and Eskimo showed up and helped me, and the first thing I wrote, I sold. Maybe I should talk about the progression of that now. Screw it. It's been good. It's been really good. My life is very simple today. I gear my life to a couple of phrases. One Cindy said Friday night. It's terribly important in my life. And it's show up. I have had to learn that all I can do is make an attempt to show up. And really, I can break showing up down into small, minute little moves. You see? I mean, if you say to me that on Monday morning I've got to be in the studio at 9 o'clock, that's great, but I really can't worry about that. But the best I can do is, you know, show up back at the motel room here, maybe, and pack. That's all I know. You know, from there we'll take it a step at a time. I will show up at the airport. Hopefully we will show up at the next airport. And, you know, I will show up at my car and I will drive it home. And if I just keep showing up, I may show up at the studio on Monday. I've tried to talk to those people there that don't understand me. You know, they say, "Oh, you're doing a fantastic job, really terrific, Jesus, great, blah, blah, blah." I say, "No, man, this is all bullshit. You don't understand. The miracle is when I drive in through the gate in the morning." You know, and they poor straight suckers look at me, you know, my opposite number does the same job I do on this particular show. And he says, "Huh?" I said, "You don't understand. I am the only person in the studio, to the best of my knowledge, that drives in the morning alone with a carpool of 6. 5 of whom do not want to come. They have other plans, bigger things. They're sick, one is sick, one is tired, one is unappreciated and wants to quit, and one wants to go to the beach." You know. But we show up. They resent the hell out of it, but my life has become incredibly simple by showing up.
I don't have to figure it out anymore. I don't have to predict what I'm going to say to them, what they're going to say to me, how the conversation is going to work out, and what the end result is, because I have no power over it. I have no power over the end result. I love what Phil said last night. Man, if you do think I would be if you had allowed me to pick my destiny, Jesus, I'd still be in the car wash. No, I'd probably be having hemorrhoid surgery, but I would still, you know. I mean, I sure as hell wouldn't be up here doing what I do, making the money I am, and feeling as good as I feel. None of what I have today would I have if it would have been left to me to pick it. But I'm lucky, because I came in here crazy, and I got crazier until I was drove to the point where I had to just sling myself on the floor in the middle of my room and say, hey, if you're not there, it's all over for me. I've got to have a power. I've got to have a God. I've got to have something. There's got to be more. I couldn't trust none of you because you're just like me. You're no tighter wrapped. You're no saner. You're no more mature. You're wacko. You know, I mean, I love AA meetings. Everybody runs around pretending like they're sane. You know, people worry about what they're going to say when they get up here because they want to impress us. I mean, that's the biggest fucking joke in the world. You know, you get up here and worry about what we're going to think of what you're going to say. Do you forget who you're talking to? Alcoholics Anonymous, dope fiends, pimps, prostitutes, adulterers, adulteresses, embezzlers, income tax evaders, dishonest corporate businessmen. You know, you're worried about what we're going to think. See? I hope I can say something profound. Yeah. I mean, we're suckers. You get your name out. We're impressed, you know. Hi, I'm George. Hi, George. I mean, you got us, you know. Jesus. I mean, the only bad days I have today is if I wake up and my head tells me that we're better. We're better now. Don't have to do a lot of those dumb things anymore. Let's try another tax. At which point I say, you go alone, you know. I can sum it all up. You see, because I never felt worthy of God. And I knew, you know, I don't know how to say it, because my head kept talking to me about how dumb I was, how I had poor education, how I never had any money, how my people were poor, how I'd been a bad guy, how I had hurt people, how I didn't deserve any good, how blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean, it wakes up in the morning. It starts, man. I don't know about you. My head loves the morning, you know. It's on the top of the headboard of the bed like a vulture saying, aha, we're awake. Let me tell you how sick you are today. The knot on your leg is bone cancer. You'll die by evening. You didn't get enough sleep. They don't pay you enough money. And we don't have time to read any of them books about God this morning. We're late. You know, I mean, getting to the shower is a miracle, for Christ's sakes. You know, much less, I mean, it's hard just getting out of the house. See? So I can't allow myself to wake up and think that I don't need the power anymore. You know, because this sucker keeps running. It's, you know, it's like an all-night market. It's just there, you know, waiting. Any opening. Heard a guy put it perfectly one day. Absolutely perfect. I've never heard it put better. He got up in the morning and he felt great. Just great. Showered and shaved, and he thought, hey, and he's going to go see his girlfriend. He really loved her, so he put on a colorful shirt. It was a summer day. Put on a pretty pair of pants. Thought, hell, she only lives 8-10 blocks away. I'll walk and enjoy, you know, what's around me. Left his apartment, walking down the street, took time to smell the flowers, looking at the grass, looking at the trees, and he said, suddenly, in broad daylight, on the sidewalk, my head mugged me. That sums it up. You know, I could just be driving along and suddenly there it is. Let's think for a while. You know, I mean, my head loves to think. And whenever a problem comes up late in the evening, it always, its first line, I can count on it, is, we can't afford to go to the meeting. We got to sit home and figure this out. Anyhow. Another big spiritual change came for me when Taylor and I were back in Unity, each trying to find whatever it was we needed to find at that time. And we spent a lot of time talking with ministers back there. And one guy I was talking with, I mentioned to him the fact, I mean, we talked about other things. We did not dwell on the situation at hand. We were talking about a lot of things, spiritual things. And I said to this guy, I said, I'm starting to feel funny because I'm starting to desire things. I'm starting to desire better things. I want to be a better person. I want to have better things. I want something. I'm just desiring things. And I said, man, and I told him where I came from and what I had done and what I was like and on and on and on. And he said to me, he said, what do you know of the origin of the word desire? And I said, nothing. I probably can't even spell it. But he said, D is from the Latin of and sire is from the Latin father. Desire of father. And I said, oh, I never thought of that. My head had convinced me that anything that I wanted was bad because I didn't deserve it. He said to me, ask yourself a question. He said, if you had available to you, yours, right at your fingertips, everything in this world, and you had a child, would you hold anything back from that child? I probably sat there for 5 minutes with that statement, because I got all these voices to listen to, the ones that, well, you got to punish kids sometimes and, teach them and blah, blah, blah. And when I got done listening to everything, I had to honestly say to him, no, if I had it all, and it was all right here at my fingertips, I would want the child to have it. I would not withhold it. He said, you are a son of your father who is in heaven. Why will he withhold from you when he has it all? He said, what I want you to do is, he said, I want you to walk out there across the field through the apple orchard and up on top of that little hill. And he said, stand on the top of that little hill. And he said, I want you to scream at the top of your lungs, I am your son and I demand what is mine. My head immediately said, yeah, sucker, you just go out there and stand on that hill and say that, you're going to be in the middle of the first tornado of the season in Missouri, I decided not to listen to my head and walked out across the stupid field through the apple orchard and up on top of the hill anyway. And I got out there all by myself and I went to scream this and the words wouldn't come out. They just strangled right here. Try and tell somebody the truth about what you're really thinking. If you want to set yourself free from your insanity, sit somebody down and tell them the truth about what you're really thinking and you'll find the words won't come up. You can't do it for a while. Finally, after about a half a dozen attempts, I reached a point where I looked at this guy and I screamed at the top of my lungs, I am your child and I demand what is mine. And I came home. That was maybe, 5 years ago. I have it all today. I have it all. My life is perfect. Yeah, my head can give you a list of things we need. My soul knows better. You see, my father loves me. Now, I am absolutely, thoroughly convinced of one thing. I believe it as much as I know I'm standing here right now. If I, coming from where I come from, living the way I've lived, struggling in sobriety the way I've struggled, with the insanity that I have, which is no different than yours, if I can walk out on the top of the hill and look at the sky and I can scream, I am your child and I demand what is mine and he gives it all to me, he will certainly give it to you. God bless you.
Typical Saturday night meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous.